For program information, audio, video and more, head to the RN homepage.
And welcome to Life Matters. Yes, any April Fool's jokes landed your way yet? Sometimes the real news headlines are so surreal, you have to wonder, don't you? Let's see what mischief some of the world's media get up today. Today, Eagle Eye. Natasha Mitchell in the chair with you this morning. As we debate the ins and outs of school funding and NAPLAN testing in Australia, consider this. Across the world, 60 million girls don't have access to education right now. A world leader with a lot on her plate is our special guest today. The former Deputy President of South Africa, now Director of UN Women, is joining us, and we cover a lot of ground together, including what her mentor, Nelson Mandela, told her early in her political life and what she's asking the men of the world to help achieve. Listen in. Pumzili Mlambo Nuka is about 20 minutes from now. At RN Life Matters is where you'll find us on Twitter, and our listener feedback line 02 833 1430. You feeling the pinch of those power bills right now? If you've built a house, have you decided perhaps against installing solar panels or other energy efficiency measures because the numbers just didn't feel like they added up for you? Your money, you felt, could be better used elsewhere. Here's the thing. Australians love to build big houses, apparently the biggest in the world, we're told. And according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 78% of us have more bedrooms than are needed for the number of people under the roof. And even if you live in a shoebox or you're a renter, the numbers you're about to hear will be of interest, I think. Researchers at RMIT have worked out what the size of Australian houses mean for hip pockets over a lifetime. Is bigger always better? To consider the findings and how we might rethink our homes and our building standards, joining me is Travis Moore. He's a research fellow at RMIT. We also have with us architect Andrew Verry, who works with a company called Jigsaw Housing. They specialise in energy efficient houses. And we also have on the line Graham Wolfe. He's chief executive of industry policy and media for the Housing Industry Association. Welcome to you all.
Morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Natasha.
Got you all there. Excellent. Travis Moore, let me start with you. What did you find in this aspect of your research?
Well, as you pointed out in your intro, we certainly have large housing in Australia, and it's been increasing for a number of years, although the recent trend over the past couple of years is that looks like it's slightly declining a little bit. But what we found was that we looked at the, you know, the through-life costs of a house, so the upfront, you know, purchase and build cost, as well as the operational costs from utilities. Mm. And when you factor that in, you know, housing can be very expensive. Sorry. And what we found is if you reduce the size of your house by, say, between 5 and 10%, the additional, say, $20,000 you would save on the slightly smaller house size could be put to making your house more sustainable and including things such as solar, which would really reduce your living costs and make the house more affordable going forward.
That's the argument you're making on basis of the findings that you or the data that you crunched. Let's just start with that saving. If that 5 to 10% saving would be in costs, would be the build cost and the energy usage cost?
Yeah, so that was on the upfront cost. If you can reduce your house size from 250 metres squared down to, say, 225 metres squared, we calculated that would probably be a saving of around $20,000 on the build cost. And Andrew will be able to tell you that if you can improve the design of the house, you won't feel like you've lost a lot of space, and then that really makes the house more affordable and manageable going forward.
So what does that size reduction amount to in terms of space? Are we talking about one room, one bedroom?
Yeah, probably, the equivalent to that spare bedroom or the second lounge, entertaining area. So, you know, it's, as you said, the ABS have found that there's, you know, 78% of households have more bedrooms than they require. So it's perhaps something that's not going to be felt by the household unless they've got, you know, guests staying over or want to use that spare room for other activities that can't be used.
Or
elsewhere.
A whole lot of junk, Travesmore, that they don't want to get rid of.
Exactly. Now, that will encourage us to have less in our house, which is probably a good thing as well.
We'll get to that. But what's key here is that saving, you think, could be redeployed. Tell us the argument.
Yeah, so I guess the argument that we often hear is that if we improve the sustainability requirements on our housing, that's going to cost extra money for, you know, improved insulation or double glazed windows or the added solar or rainwater tanks. These things all cost money.
Big deterrent for people, isn't it? That upfront cost.
If people are stretched already and housing is considered unaffordable, then what we need to do is start to think of ways which we can make these sustainability elements more affordable, and one way is to slightly reduce the house size, and you could then incorporate that money you've saved on the house size into the sustainability elements.
Okay, so this is a quest that you have to achieve zero emissions housing. What do you mean by that?
Basically, we're looking at housing from the through life perspective. So you have environmental impacts in the materials that you use, the building processes, but also the main impacts come from the operation of the house through the use of energy and water, and particularly through the use of fossil fuels. And then you have impacts at the end of life when you're disposing of the house and the materials and into reuse or recycling or into the waste stream. So our focus is primarily at the moment on the operational phase of the house and trying to reduce the impacts from those fossil fuels, I guess, by offsetting, well, firstly reducing your energy requirements by having an efficient thermal envelope of the building, but then improving occupant behaviour and then offsetting the rest of the energy through the use of solar.
So it's the whole grab bag, and I'll come to Andrew Verry, our architect from Jigsaw Housing, as to how you approach that, Andrew, but let me come to Graham Wolfe, Chief Executive of Industry Policy and Media at the Housing Industry Association. Many people, Graham, buy project homes, and it is mighty hard to get a smaller house now, is it not?
Well, probably not as hard as it was 10 or 15 years ago. We certainly have been seeing the size of lots of land declining over the last decade. And so builders are being forced in some way to design homes that fit a smaller footprint, a smaller lot of land. So there are quite a large range of houses out there that will be, you know, much smaller than the average. The average is about 250 square metre home, but much, much smaller than that, and certainly, you know, into the 17 and 18 square home. So they are available. It's just that a lot of people, when they're making that big decision, they're making a decision that's probably going to last them for 10 or 15 or 20 years or more, that they are interested in perhaps having that extra bedroom. It might be redundant at day one, but the family might increase in size, or parents might come back and visit, or families tend to grow and shrink over the course of a generation.
So, and that's the attraction, you think, that for bigger houses?
Well, it's the attraction for the extra bedroom, certainly, and you jest a little bit about where do you put your junk, but a lot of people do have space problems in houses, and the extra bedroom does come in handy for that, and particularly when the kids have a friend come over to stay for the weekend. So people think about that. They're very conscious about the adaptability of a house, and those extra spaces are very important.
But as we've heard, it's costing them, and those are costs that they don't anticipate or don't plan for. So just thinking about, I mean, you mentioned the land footprint of houses, but what about the ecological footprint? And this is a question I have for you. How proactive is the housing industry now in terms of integrating energy efficiency elements into the design, the construction of houses? Or is this still very much only if the consumer wants it?
Well, there'd be two answers to that. I would argue that the industry over the last decade has come a long way. HIA, for example, has its Green Smart program, and it has trained about 6,000 members through a program that takes them through the whole sustainability debate and a lot of the issues around water quality, conservation, as well as energy efficiency, and also training or at least informing their clients about how to use a property that is a much more thermally efficient home than perhaps the homes we were building 10 or 15 years ago. So the industry has come a long way in both complying with higher stringency standards for star ratings of homes, but also in voluntarily providing information and opportunities for their clients to improve the performance of their home.
Certainly though, Graham, we still see, and I see, new housing developments pop up en masse in areas I know well, and they don't have solar, and you can't see evidence of water tanks. And you then start to wonder about the energy efficiency of the design. So this isn't happening on a mass scale in the way that it might and would make sense, it would seem.
Well, houses in New South Wales, but in most states, will have a water tank, new houses, and there'll be minimum requirements for that to be met. People, when they're making decisions about the size of the water tank, will look at the size of the allotment. Water tanks are particularly useful for helping with not only flushing toilets, but also for use out in the yard space. And as I said, as lots of land becomes smaller, the more efficient use of yard space means that there's probably less water consumption going on. But a water tank does add considerable savings to a house.
What about solar panels?
Solar panels are an option for houses. Obviously, the solar aspect of the roof is important as to whether or not the efficiency of those solar panels are going to be high or low. And people are encouraged to do that because it certainly does reduce their energy consumption costs, and that's very important.
Mm, the trick is whether we're doing enough to require houses to be built from the ground up. Andrew Verry from Jigsaw Housing, you're involved in this very challenge of helping clients integrate energy efficiency elements into the designs that you come up with. Do people want to compromise on space?
We just give them a choice. I think what we offer is someone who thinks about the design and not just seeing it as an afterthought, but that critical thinking is applied early. We ran a workshop recently in Canberra about 2 years ago, and we just asked mums and dads and young couples and single people, what do they want from a house? And we didn't want any industry there. We just wanted to hear what they had to say. And so we run the workshop under the banner of 200K, you know, 8-star house. Is it possible to build an 8-star energy efficient house for $200,000? And what came out of that workshop, people had a choice, and they came back and they said, look, light was important, warmth was important, connection to the outdoors was important, and a good social space. Mm. And that's a very different brief to what you see on most, I guess, home listings or what most real estate agents say that you need in the house. And it wasn't a collection of rooms, but it was rather how do those rooms perform. And then from that, we just distilled down two bedrooms was enough, and a little study space was enough, and it was one living room and a dining room was enough within that budget. We're not saying that everyone should build a two-bedroom house with only one.
Depends on your family size, yes.
Exactly.
But that was key, that you could integrate what people desired into a clever design.
Exactly, from that workshop, so as a collective. So I think we've lost the art of saying how much space do we need, and like Graham was saying, we're building for the future, but I think we always err on the side of, well, bigger is better because I can't make it smaller later on, where I actually think now, with the work that Travis is doing, that we're starting to ask ourselves, how much space do we actually need, and maybe we do have extra space that isn't being utilised, And when you think of the report earlier about, you know, we're a very lucky country compared to other countries. And then if we want to use 16 planets to keep our consumption habits going, well, then, you know, that's our choice, I suppose. But we could also think more globally and say, hey, you know, enough is enough. Let's start applying some critical thought.
So size is one thing, but your challenge is to design for energy efficiency, isn't it? That's your premise.
It's the premise. There's a builder, an architect, and a scientist, and energy efficiency just goes with good design. It's not an afterthought.
How does it go with good design? Tell us about that relationship.
Good design is, architects are good at, I guess, problem solving and then setting ourselves a challenge. And that challenge would be to look at energy efficiency. So with good design comes orientation. So orientation is, you know, where's most of my windows facing? In Canberra, we're predominantly a heating climate. We require heating. So therefore, being able to capture that sun, bringing light into the house and warmth, free energy, is something that you just have to do as a given. It's not something you do because you have to. It's something that you do because it just makes good sense.
Yeah, indeed. So it's not just about having solar panels on your roof. This is a whole other range of subtleties.
Exactly. I think the first one is orientation. So the first, and Travis would agree with this, that orientation and insulation are two givens. They don't cost any more for orientation of the house. One would argue that you do have to maybe pay for an architect or someone who's got some good design credentials or some good runs on the board, I suppose, around this house. Not everyone needs to be an architect in designing homes. I mean, mums and dads and everyone has a go at it. We're all architects. We all sort of know the space we want. I think it's just experience that makes it easier as we go along. But orientation and insulation, they are the first fundamentals. And if you get those right, you can then meet the minimum building standards with a 6-star energy efficient house at no extra cost. Mm. And that's what we worked out in our workshop. But to get to 8 stars, which is 8 stars is half the energy use of a 6-star home in Canberra, in our heating climate, then you have to do a few extra little things.
I might come back if we've got time, but let me come in back to Travis Moore, research fellow at RMIT. We heard from Graham Wolfe from the housing industry. Do governments have a role here to, in a sense, incentivise on this one? Do they have a role in terms of regulation and incentives to encourage people, one, to design their house differently, but also to reduce their size?
Yeah, I certainly think there is a role for the government to play here. We've seen the, as Graham has said, the industry and the government have worked together over the past decade or so, and we've seen the introduction of minimum star rating standards across the country, and we've seen those increase at different periods. So, you know, that is starting to lift the bar across all new housing, and we're starting to see some builders and architects, such as Jigsaw Housing, kind of starting to move beyond the minimum requirements.
Is it enough?
Well, what we need is we need to start seeing some demonstration projects out there. We need to start seeing that, you know, you can build an 8-star or a 9-star or 10-star house or whatever the optimum, star rating might be, and starting to include these other elements to start thinking about, you know, the through life sustainability of the house. And the government certainly has a role there to play in educating the building industry as well as consumers, as well as working on those minimum regulations. And we're seeing in countries such as, you know, the UK and in places such as California, they've set out a 10-year kind of stepwise regulation approach to move towards low and zero energy and emission housing by the end of the decade. So regulation is certainly driving that in other countries. I think we need to look beyond just the regulations as well and start thinking about, you know, things such as finances. So the argument is, if it's the sustainability elements cost too much, then how can we work on ways to try and reduce those upfront costs for those? And, you know, it might be that we need to start talking to the banks and getting them to recognise that, you know, the higher performance of the house, the sustainability of the house, will lead to lower operational costs, which may mean that then slightly more money could be borrowed up front, knowing that the ability to repay that will be greater because there's lower living costs in
down
that
the
house.
Track. Down the track, so in a sense, restructure mortgages.
Yeah, that could be possibly one approach. Some of the littler banks in Australia now, I notice, are offering things such as, you know, if you have money for, or, you know, you want to get additional money to put solar on your house, you can pause your mortgage repayments for, you know, a couple of months to allow you to absorb that extra money. Mm. So, you know, there's some something's starting to happen there, but I guess it's taking it from the fringes to make this mainstream and to make it standard and not seen as, you know, that alternative type of housing.
Yes, not just outlier housing. Graham Wolfe from the Housing Industry Association, how would you feel if, and how would the industry feel if we followed the path of the UK and California that Travesse just mentioned there, with an aim for low or zero emission housing by the end of the decade?
Well, there's the first point is obviously there is a very different climate zone difference between UK and Australia. So we need to be very much aware of the various climate zones that exist around Australia, from North Queensland down to Canberra and Melbourne and Tasmania. So there are different design parameters that need to be contemplated in terms of the energy efficiency of the home. But moving into a more thermal performing home, moving into a lower emitting homes and down to zero emission homes with on-site power generation, this is the direction that we're moving in. This is the direction we'll continue to move in. And I think as technology improves and as prices become more affordable, people will automatically be turned to that to those projects. But I think it's also important too to recognise that we can build a very, very thermally efficient home. We can put solar performers on the roof. But if we don't have people properly educated about, one, the thermal performance of their home, and two, the climate that they're living in, we can miss out on all the advantages. And you know, we've seen examples where we're building 6, 7, and 8-star homes in Queensland. They're built along the principle of an Esky, where we're making them very thermal efficient, but we put an air conditioner in them, they close all the windows and doors and leave the air conditioner running all day, and that doesn't seem to be the right outcome that we're trying to achieve.
Defeats the purpose. There's so much more to this discussion. I think we'll pursue it again with you all, and a timely conversation given the release of the fifth assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I think. But yes, and also the challenge, though, of people wanting to accommodate multiple generations in houses now. Can I thank Travesse Moore, Research Fellow at RMIT, Andrew Verry, an architect at Jigsaw Housing based in Canberra, and Graham Wolfe, Chief Executive of Industry Policy and Media at the Housing Industry Association. Thanks, fellows.
Thanks, Natasha. Yeah.
Thanks for that.
And on Life Matters, I know you'll have stuff to say about this. We'll pop a post up on our Facebook page, and very interested to hear from you if you've built a house from scratch and some of the decisions and compromises that you made along the way. Get in touch, and our listener feedback line 02-833-1430. I'll look up next, a woman on a mission, the former Deputy President of South Africa, now head of UN Women. There are worse
things than staring at someone fresh above. Bernadette Peters. She's one of the biggest stars the Broadway stage has ever seen. What are her thoughts about musical theatre of old, Stephen Sondheim, and what makes a hit musical? She'll tell us. We'll also be taking a look at a new type of musical theatre emerging here in Australia, the non-composer-led musical. Join me, Melanie Tate, for Weekend Arts anytime from the RN website.
Well, big bold leaps, not baby steps, is what my next guest wants to see to improve the lives of women worldwide. She was a leader in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. For 6 years, she was South Africa's Minister of Minerals and Energy. And in 2005, Dr. Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka was appointed Deputy President of South Africa, the first woman in that role. And in August last year, she was sworn in by Ban Ki-moon as the new Executive Director of UN Women, replacing the inaugural Director, Michelle Bachelet, who resigned, no less, to be re-elected as the President in Chile. UN Women is focused on gender equality and the empowerment of women worldwide. And if you are the parent of a daughter, these figures should scare the wits out of you. 60 million girls worldwide don't have access to education right now. Recent figures estimate that 35% of women globally have experienced either intimate partner violence or non-partner sexual violence in their lifetime. Women make up 70% of the world's poor. And if you're a girl or a woman aged between 16 and 44, violence is the major cause of death and disability for girls and women. So our next guest has something of a mammoth task, like few others, but as she often explains, it's a task for all of us. And Phumzile joined me on the line from Tokyo a little earlier.
Hi, hi, how are you? Good morning to you and your audience.
It's wonderful to have you with us. I wanted to set the scene of your own career, if we can. And I want to know where you started out. I gather your father was a school teacher, your mother a community health nurse, focused on family planning. You describe her as a particularly determined woman.
Yes. Yes, no, indeed. And interestingly, she was a community health nurse focusing on reproductive health issues, which is what dominates my life these days, so to say. And being Catholic, she obviously in those days had a lot in her hands to push forward on. So, I mean, I learned quite early in life that, you know, there are some things that you just have to stand for and sometimes just push against the tide.
What did she stand for? Because, as you point out, your family was Catholic, and here your mother was grappling with issues of contraception and reproductive rights in her work as a nurse. Did she bring those issues home to your kitchen table?
Yes. I cannot claim I understood them fully at the time. But, you know, as you grow older and then you grasp it, and then you realize how important it was, for instance, to make sure that girls have got rights as well as responsibilities, and that it's important that girls stand up and do some of the things that they feel strongly about, and that they must not feel intimidated by boys. Interesting enough for the Australian audience is that I was also associated in those days with the YWCA, which is very strong in Australia. And some of my youthful friends, as I grew up in sort of the student and youth movement, were Australian, because through the YWCA we were in touch with young people around the world.
Yes, absolutely. That you were very much involved in the women's movement within and the young people's movement within the YWCA. But also, back in 1983, you became the first president of what was called the Natal Organisation of Women, born out of the United Democratic Front, born out of the anti-apartheid movement. Can you reflect for us the extent to which you think the anti-apartheid movement was a woman's movement?
Well, it was a women's movement because the majority of the people, if you think about oppression, that had a lot to lose from apartheid was women, because of the triple oppression. Women were oppressed because of race, class and gender. So this was a big deal for women to be part of the leadership and to be as active as possible. And women played a significant role in the anti-apartheid struggle. That is why South Africa, in its post-apartheid constitution, had such a strong emphasis on the emancipation of women, almost as an integral part of winning the struggle against apartheid.
Was it integral?
Yes, at least at the level of the constitution, but the implementation is work in progress, you know, like it is in many countries that have got, that enshrine equality of women in their constitution. It continues. There is no country that has achieved total equality. It's work in progress, harder in some countries. South Africa is one of those where it's much more difficult for people to discriminate against you blatantly. But a lot of women have much harder lives still. Mm. So the work is, you know, it's a tall order, violence against women, poverty, and so on.
Yes, and certainly the impact of HIV/AIDS. And I know your mother, I think, is in her 80s now and very much still working hard, running a family-based program for those families. But if we come to South Africa post-apartheid, you know, this is an issue worldwide. It's an issue in our own country too. But the incidence of rape and of murder and of violence by intimate partners against women in South Africa especially is terrifyingly high. And I wonder how you reflect on what's gone wrong for women in South Africa post-apartheid.
Well, for one, I think that the reporting is much stronger, because the issue is very much talked about. There's greater encouragement for women to tackle the issue both in their what happens in their private homes as well as what happens in the public space. But also, I think that we also have a lot of pushback in South Africa. Some of the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, in the many of in much legislation that has come about in post-apartheid, notwithstanding that women do not enjoy all the rights as yet that come with that legislation, because, as you know, implementing some of these new laws can be a challenge. But the fact that there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of public support, has also elicited a lot of pushback. Some of which I'm not talking scientifically here, but you know, some of which I think manifests itself into violence. For some of the men that may be feeling that women are sort of taking their place, you know, so to say. So it really has been quite frightening. You know, this subsurgence of violence.
Yes, indeed. And we will come to the role of men, because that is very much key in your work now. Mm. And law is a big issue, isn't it? In around 102 countries, there are no specific legal provisions against domestic violence.
In at least it's twofold. Where we have legislation, which is a good start, we need to still push in order to make sure that implementation is as effective as possible. In those countries where there is no law to begin with, we need to make sure that we start there with ensuring that the right legal framework is provided.
And I mean, it's sobering also to be reminded that in 53 countries, marital rape is not a prosecutable offence.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of a country closer to home, here in Australia, and in our region, in Papua New Guinea. Like South Africa, this is a country where violence against girls and women is now acknowledged as extreme and frightening. And until recently, there was only one woman member of parliament. Now there are just three. And I wonder how you reflect, as former deputy president of South Africa, on the role of whether women in parliament make a key difference.
Well, definitely women in parliament, but you actually do need a critical mass. I can just imagine how difficult it is to be one woman in the house surrounded by men most likely skeptical. You know, in that situation, more than in any other situation, identifying the men that we call the he for she becomes very important.
This is he for she. This is the campaign that you're running now through UN Women.
It's men that can stand on the right side of history and support the rights of women. I would imagine in a situation where you just one or three women in the Houses of Parliament, it's important to create a critical mass out of the men that are there. But really, the push through quotas, through targets and other means to fast-track the representation of women becomes very important, because I don't know of any country yet which has been able to do it without this added pressure that the quotas bring to bear. UN Women is actually working in Papua New Guinea quite a bit. We intend to focus, for all of these reasons that you've mentioned, it is one of the countries that we regard as a critical country for us to make a difference in. We do work and collaborate with the some of the other UN agencies in PNG in order to make sure that we could pull our resources together. Hopefully, in the next election, we would really pull all stop to support women candidates.
Even when you do have women candidates, you yourself have acknowledged that women in power aren't always supporters of other women.
I think I wouldn't make that the overwhelming case. I think that overwhelmingly women do the right thing when they're in power. But I also don't want to give an impression that it's all perfect. When it comes into passing reforming legislation, I think that in almost all cases, women will do the right thing. It's probably at a more personal level that sometimes support is not always there. But when it comes into women in parliament, given that the work of a parliamentarian is to pass law, women will tend to pass the right laws and support the right policies that support women and children especially.
On Life Matters this morning, Natasha Mitchell with you, and we are joined today by a very special guest, the new Executive Director of UN Women, Dr. Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka. UN Women is charged, is the UN body responsible for gender equality and the empowerment of women right across the globe. You mentioned quotas, there's been a very lively debate, Phumzile, on quotas in Australia within Parliament. Certainly in Australia currently we only have one woman in the cabinet of senior ministers who run the country. Mm. And quotas are definitely controversial. Your predecessor, Michelle Bachelet, now Chilean president, made quite a forceful argument for quota systems in parliaments worldwide. Mm. How receptive have parliaments been to the call by UN Women for quotas, given the controversy?
Well, I think that when people question the quotas and they don't give us something that is an alternative that will work, I just think that it's another excuse to push back. I think that the arguments that are given are quite academic, because we are dealing here with a situation where the force of patriarchy is much stronger. And the fact that also women will elect men is also an issue, because there just isn't enough role models of women. So women sometimes will go with what is available in their countries and in their communities based on what that has always been there. Because, I mean, not all women are born active feminists, so to say. So if we want to break the ground, we need these extraordinary measures, because the playing field is not leveled. So if we push back and we refuse to have quotas and we do not provide anything in its place, we might as well, you know, wait for, you know, the next generations to achieve gender equality, which is clearly not acceptable. Right now, we have 1 out of 5 women as a parliamentarian, from 1 out of 10 in 2010. I mean, this is very slow progress for a population of women that is more than 51%. So the world is underperforming grossly on this issue. And if we're not going to bring in extraordinary measures, we shortchanging women.
It starts
shortchanging society, actually, because where you do have women, especially in developing countries, you know, women will fight for addressing maternal health, infant mortality, education for girls, poverty, all of those things that we all care about.
It starts with women, but it also starts with men for you, and you alluded to your He for She campaign. For men who are listening, you're making a strong case with this campaign that we need to broaden the foot soldiers for gender equality, as you describe it. Yes. For men who are listening, what examples can you give for where they can start as part of this campaign?
I think that to begin with, I think that there's a lot of men who do not want to oppress any woman, who, even though they don't want to oppress any women, but also will not do anything about it. What we are saying is that inaction and indifference is conspiracy against women, because it does not take us forward. When men are fathers, they are brothers, they are partners, and so on. So all of those, in all of those roles, they probably would like those significant others to have a much better life. I don't think that men in general want girls to be paid less for equal work to that of men. They do not want women to be poor and to transmit poverty to the next generation of in their offsprings. And so on. So we want them, if they are employers, they must look at the practices in the places where they make decisions, that, and make sure that the practices and the policies promote equality. If they are leaders in the religious community, they must address those barriers and those practices in those institutions. We are asking men to do the right thing where they are, but also to organize themselves and to take a step and a stand that is visible. We want them to address the issue of violence against women. The fact that one out of three women will experience violence, physical or sexual, that takes us to about 1 billion women in the world. That's a pandemic by any, you know, description. Can you imagine if there was any disease that affected so many people in the world? So many people will be running around trying to address it, from scientists to people in community. And yet, when it comes to the issues of violence against women, it just tends to be women trying to support women. And this is not a sustainable solution. We need to broaden the front of consent citizens.
And speaking of he for she, a certain individual took a chance on you, and that was no less than Nelson Mandela.
Yes. Well, I always talk about my first appointment into cabinet as taking a chance, because I got appointed into an area that I wasn't an expert on, which was trade and industry. And when I did ask him what were the expectations given my limited knowledge, and she said, well, I expect you to learn. I also did not train to become a president of a country. I was a prisoner for a long time, as you know. I'm doing my best. Go do your best. It is really a humble and humorous way, and I never looked back.
You certainly haven't.
Absolutely. I just said, okay, this is the drill. I must go there and do my best.
The courage of your convictions. One of the things that you feel convinced about, and a key interest of yours in this role as head of UN Women, is the impact of war and emergency situations on women and girls. And the International Rescue Committee released a horrific report on the civil war in Syria, indicating that the sexual violence against women and girls was significant, was a disturbing feature of this conflict. It is happening right now. This is a very frightening scenario. What do you think can be done to protect women, like Syrian women, in the thick of war, when really, to the rest of the world, it all seems hopeless in terms of our access to these women and the over a million children affected by this conflict?
Again, we need to strengthen and to support civil society in all these countries where we're facing conflict, so that we do have people that monitor, that take action, and that support women. But also, because some of this violence needs to be a concern of governments, of states, of the troops and soldiers that are supposed to, law enforcers that are supposed to protect women. We need to invest in the training of people who work in those institutions, so that we make them aware of all of these gender-related and gender-based violence.
But the difficulty is that we have a war going on right now, and I guess this alludes to our previous part of the conversation, that there are very few women. When you look at the faces of those big, powerful bodies, there are few women in the G20. There are very few faces on the UN Security Council. Very few women are involved in peace negotiations, and very few women, it seems, are pulling the levers of war.
This is the responsibility of states. I mean, in the midst of a war, when the conflict has already broken, it is much more difficult, because, people are basically dying, and the intervention in the thickness of war becomes very difficult. But having said that, because you cannot actually go into a country that is already in combat, and you are not likely to find responses when you are insisting that you want to involve women in the war. That's not what you'd like, because in any case, you'd be wanting to save the women. You want to take the women out of the war. You want to protect the women. Our intervention in those cases is that those of us that are active in humanitarian services and supporting women, we pay in supporting people that are caught up in conflict, we pay particular attention to the circumstances of women. A gender-blind approach when we're providing humanitarian services and rescue services can actually victimize women again. And these are the kinds of services that we tend to provide as UN Women. But I mean, having said that, it's still not adequate because usually the numbers are much more than, you know, what we are able to cope and to deal with. The usual number is that in most situations, about 70% of people that are affected by war and displaced are women and children. So by any count, that's a very large number. Recently, when I was in South Sudan and visiting the camps with displaced people, you know, women were talking to me about the fear of losing the camp because they're afraid of being attacked while they're outside. Staying in the camp and not having access to medical care, they are cramped, access to water, food is running out. So they spend their time in the camp worrying about the survival of their families. They are afraid to go out because it is not safe to them. For them, they are afraid of being attacked. Men are afraid of being attacked and by whoever would be an enemy to them. Women are afraid of being attacked by people who could molest them in one way or the other.
Mm.
So it's hell for women, whatever the circumstances are. And that is why you need men to be part of the solution, because the protection that women need cannot only be provided by women's organization. It has to be provided by those who have authority and power, but also by caring men who, even if they are not in authority, are concerned enough to want to take a stand and support women.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I just want to bring in that issue of men supporting women, and particularly fathers supporting girls, because this is another issue very close to your heart,
yes.
And that is 60 million girls worldwide. I think people forget that figure. 60 million girls worldwide are denied access to education. What role can fathers have?
I just think that starting from home, fathers must be effective where they are. Protecting your own daughter starts in your own home, making sure that between the brother and the sister, you treat the girl in such a way that you support them in being an assertive girl, that you do not reinforce the stereotypes that are there in many of our communities, but also that fathers really need to address the issue of violence against women, because sometimes girls would go and marry an abuser, and when they run back home, the parents will send them back. In some communities, as you know, we've got honor killings where the family is involved in subjecting the young girl and the young woman to death in some cases if they think that she has dishonored the family. So we need the fathers to actually stand up. Fathers are, in many cases, heads of corporations. They are leaders in the churches. They are leaders in communities. And by and large, they are the people that are part of decision-making in most societies. So we need them to change the tune and speak on behalf of and in support of women and girls.
And that will connect with many fathers across Australia.
Exactly.
And
in some ways, you know, fathers are much more concerned about protecting their daughters than protecting their partners. But, you know, it's better to start somewhere. That is already a step in the right direction.
And you have certainly done more than that. Finally, in the last minute, what is ahead for you in the year ahead as you assume this role?
Well, we are planning now to commemorate Beijing Plus 20, urging countries to really look deep into their society about what has changed in the last 20 years. How could we make sure that in the post-2015 agenda for development that the United Nations is going to be championing, we put in place a completely new dispensation, as I'm saying, not baby steps, bold steps. Because, you know, this hasn't been going on for more than 100 years. So we now are at a crossroads. We need to find a way of doing things that will be destiny-changing for the lives of women and girls, no matter where they are and no matter who they are. They need to feel the changes that we're going to be bringing together.
Well, it is terrific to have you on Life Matters today here on Radio National. Dr. Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka, thank you for making time in a very busy schedule, we know.
Thank you. Thank Thank you so much.
And Pumzili Mlambo Ngunka, she is the executive director of UN Women, joining us on the line from Tokyo. A big task ahead for her. And the He for She campaign, you can actually upload videos to that. We've popped a link on the Facebook page, the Life Matters Facebook page, but you can head straight to the website. It's just heforshe.org. Well worth finding out, some great messages from men worldwide being popped up there. On Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you. I think we just have enough time for some feedback, and I'll come straight to some of your responses to our conversation at the top of the show about building smaller houses and energy efficient houses. Rebecca says on our Facebook page, this idea is old. See the tiny house movement, which is fantastically interesting. I love some of those challenges that people set for themselves. Sonia from Anglesey has sent us a text message. We tried to have a small, simple, sustainable architect-designed home. We approached several architects. All options were ridiculously expensive and unaffordable. Building small to save money towards architect design sustainability was not possible, even though we thought we had a reasonable budget to do so. Can we only build sustainably if we are wealthy? How can we do this? And John's written, the way we build houses and the fact that 99% of the population think of a house as something you can buy from a catalogue and plonk on a block are the two biggest issues. Have just finished two bedroom houses, one for a middle-aged couple, one for an older couple. One is on a huge block in the bush, the other is on a small block at the beach. Both clients ask for what they need, having both done the big house thing in the past. The cheapest thing that houses need is correct orientation. It costs nothing. Places not needing any heating or cooling is easy in many locations. We're also doing places that can be renovated without changing the main structure, so the material waste of ripping it apart every 20 years is avoided. So many options beyond the brick and tile box on a slab that the industry wants to sell us. And Polly has squeezed in, we have two bedrooms and possible third if we could move the thousands of books. But now we have five grandchildren, we need two more bedrooms. We could never downsize, although I agree with the idea of using less space. Big response yesterday, as I thought we might have, to our conversation about stepmothers and the complexity of that role. And Jacqueline writes, I was a step-parent to the most beautiful children. Then my marriage broke up. Not only did he take away the marriage, he took away the children, which was the biggest loss of all. It's now 20 years. I have my own children, however. I still wonder about those girls and how they are. I also, now again, am a step-parent of grown-up boys and they are absolutely divine. However, it took some work. They have young children the same age as my little girl, and things that are important can take time, and sometimes it doesn't go to plan. Thanks, Jacqueline. And John has emailed us. I'm a stepfather and was told to not get involved with three children as they already had a father. I was just a provider, and in many cases, an outsider. Thank you for that email, John. And on our website, Lily's written, it's a tough gig. I can relate, really relate to the examples spoken about in this story, especially in regards to having no say in decisions around the children and not being listened to, yet still having to enforce rules and decisions. It wears you down. Stepmother love is not a simple love. I do have a good relationship with my stepdaughters, but one in particular is very difficult to live with. I often have fantasies about just up and leaving too. Sometimes it is so disheartening. I love my partner and I love my family, but I honestly do not know if I can keep living with them. And yes, look, many more comments besides on that. It's a complex relationship, and you can catch up with that interview that we did about stepmother love on our website, abc.net.au/RN. And look for Life Matters, and we're all there. You can email us from there too on anything that you've heard, and we'd love to hear your story ideas. But Michael Cathcart is waiting in the wings. Books and Arts Daily, our daily arts and culture show, coming up after the news. Who's on?
Yeah, well, look, went for a walk at the weekend with some friends, mm-hmm. and they had two little daughters, and I told them I was going to interview Andy Griffiths, and their eyes lit up. They were so excited. And not only did they know about the 13-story treehouse and told me the plot, they knew about the 26-story treehouse, the 39-story treehouse. Andy Griffiths is huge with kids.
Do you know it's actually my fantasy to have a treehouse?
Well, okay. Well, you better listen to the show, because this is...
I better read a bit more Andy Griffiths.
Yeah, it might be a bit daunting because when you look at the picture of the 13-storey treehouse, it doesn't look like sustainable living, I have to say.
the ultimate fantasy treehouse was, remember the comic Phantom?
Oh, yeah.
The Phantom comic. He got married to Diana and their house was this magical palace in a tree.
And he got into it in a basket that you pulled up with a rope.
You so did, but it had modern bathrooms and it was a classic. I'll never forget that.
I didn't know you liked The Phantom.
I grew up with The Phantom. Yeah, my parents were a bit obsessed, but that's another story.
We should form a support group.
I fully recovered from The Phantom. Thanks for that, Michael.
Good on you.
And looking forward to your company next on Life Matters. Hey, it's 10 a.m. on RN.
Get ready to reach for your iPad. Something really special has landed. It's RN's brand new, definitely shiny, White Paper. A monthly digital magazine to watch, read, listen to, on the train, on the plane, on the couch. It's smart, lush to look at, everything you love about RN right in your lap. Want to know more? You know where to head. The RN homepage and look for White Paper. It's free.